often folks will say, oh, you know, he's writing about Muslim American identity. No, I'm not. Mm-hmm. For many people, seeing characters who are struggling in some cases with their place in this country as part of the sort of existential circumstance of their lives becomes a political statement or becomes like some conscious artistic intention.
Do you like books?
I'm outlining a new writing project.
Who wrote this book?
Read it. Reread it.
Sometimes I'd write something.
What are you writing?
Have you written anything lately?
I'm Amanda Stern, and this is Bookable. On today's show, identity politics. What happens when you write about the American experience from two opposing viewpoints? In novelist and playwright Ayad Akhtar's latest book, we follow the rise of Trump, white supremacy, and the consequences of falling prey to American capitalism when you're a hard-working immigrant. We asked Kathy Park Hong, poet and author of the critically acclaimed essay collection Minor Feelings, to talk to Ayad about his new novel, Homeland Elegies. Together, they enter deep territory discussing everything from books that break form, meta-narration, abandoned ideas, Black American cynicism, character, and the American immigrant experience. Their conversation is smart, insightful, political, and, to be quite honest, very occasionally over my head. Here's Kathy.
I just want to say it's amazing how you use the novel to track sort of the fall of American empire, its foreign policy, its unchecked capitalism, its racism, beginning from 9/11 to Trump. And I remember, you know, I think, you know, I was having this conversation with a friend. We couldn't think of any sort of definitive 9/11 novel or Trump novel. I don't really think such a novel exists, but I think if there was going to be, I was thinking at the time that if there was going to be any real honest appraisal of this time period, it wouldn't come from a white male writer, but a woman or a person of color. And I think your book really captures my theory. Two of the reasons why I love the book is because its form doesn't read as a typical or more conventional realist novel. It seems you're using the novel more as an argument or as an essay. It's not afraid to tell rather than just show. It seems like you're seeking to not only make people feel, but persuade. And underneath that, I think it's an indictment of a lot of the American values that we hold dear. I also really fell in love with the book because of its characters, especially the father figure. Right. For those who haven't really read the book, it begins with the narrator's father meeting Trump and becoming his doctor very briefly and being lured in by his charisma. And the father may or may not have voted for him in 2016. I think, like, you know, in the media when they talk about the shy Trump voter, I'm thinking, oh, it's probably people like him, you know, the mythical. I don't think there are as many shy Trump voters as people are afraid of, but I'm thinking, oh, it's probably immigrants like him. But anyway, but I also love how the narrator's own personal familial connections are ensnared in a lot of these cataclysmic moments in recent history, such as 9/11 and the war in the Middle East and the rise of Trump and white supremacy. So after my long-winded introduction, this is kind of my question. I want to start with the character of the father. I have to say, like, I recognize so much of my own father and your father. I really did. I think.
Where is your dad?
My dad is in LA. He's Korean. And he's also this like sort of aspirational Asian immigrant.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of these aspirational Asian immigrants are just kind of these cardboard cutouts of the hardworking immigrant, but you really managed to kind of capture the kaleidoscope of insecurity, machismo, stubbornness.
That's right.
You know, humor, affection, just everything that's infuriating about the immigrant dad.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could, and especially the immigrant dad who worships the Church of American Capitalism,
right,
but then who ultimately becomes betrayed by it from other corporate apex predators and racism. Mm. And I think I could also relate to that with the story of my father. Right. And so I was just wondering if you could talk about this father figure, this father character, how you developed him, how you developed this character, and how challenging it was to make him such this kind of unvarnished, honest immigrant. You know, because you also talk about his racism too, which I think, even if it's fiction, it seems like it would be hard to write about.
Right. thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for the amazing tribute at the opening. And really, it touches me deeply. Some of the stuff you said. Mm-hmm. My dad is substantially the model of this father in the book, and I couldn't, you know, I wouldn't know how to create somebody who had so many sort of contradictions. Mm-hmm. I remember when I first encountered Falstaff in Henry the Fourth's Parts 1 and 2, and I remember reading, you know, this amazing character Falstaff and thinking, well, I know this guy. This guy's a lot like my dad. You know, I think that he has been a template for me of sort of contradiction and larger than lifeness. And I've been going to school on him as a kind of attempt to characterize and sort of put him down on paper, if you will, to kind of capture this sense of all these things you're talking about, the vulnerability and the machismo and the outsized gifts. You know, he was a very gifted man and also a very generous man. And, all of that stuff. So it wasn't too hard to write him. I think that the challenge for me personally was that I was losing my father to alcoholism, and I'd lost. Mm. He had decamped about two years earlier, and in a way, I think writing the book was like an attempt to kind of bring him back, if you will. You know, and as a dramatic writer, of course, I am concocting and I am sharpening edges and I am compositing and I am pushing things to an extreme. And, you know, I'm creating oppositions because I think that the stronger the oppositions, the more energy is created inside a story. And that's just my thinking as a dramatic writer. So I did take liberties, but the liberties I took ultimately were, you know, they were intuitive. They were not conceptual. You know, other than the fact that, you know, very obviously the mother and the father stand in as opposite poles of responding to the American experience. And, you know, on the one hand, you have the caricature of Trump as embodying the full spectrum of American individualism. And on the other hand, you have Bin Laden as standing in as a kind of critic of American imperialism. So between those two points of view on America, the politics of the book unfold.
I figured that like it was actually based on your father, but I didn't want to say that outright.
Sure.
Has he read it actually? Has he read the book?
So the day that I have this very long chapter, as you know, that ends the book, which is about my father's, about a court case that my father, quote unquote, in the book, it undergoes. And it's really kind of it's a portrait of Wisconsin, but it's also kind of a portrait of his belonging in America or how it sort of ends. Mm-hmm. And my dad, you know, the day that I finished that chapter, I got a call from my brother that my dad was in ICU. He was taken to ICU and he died shortly thereafter. So he died the day I finished the book.
Oh, wow. Oh yeah,
which was a very strange, as a writer, you some strange things can happen to you when you're writing.
I know
some very weird coincidences and stuff, and this was, you know, the weirdest of them all. I didn't worry that he would read it just because he was drunk most of the day every day, and I can't imagine he would. would have been able to read anything. Mm-hmm. And also, he was not a big reader. I mean, he was very much mm-hmm. sort of like man of action and, you know, don't waste mm-hmm. my time with staring at paper kind of guy, you know. So I didn't worry too much about that. But I also mm-hmm. knew in my gut, you know, what I was mm-hmm. doing to him. You know, and mm-hmm. I sort of stage it a bit in the book where, you know, the writer leaves the journal out and then the father sees all the notes that he's taken and, mm-hmm. you know, the father's concerned about how he's going to be portrayed in the book. You know, I unfolded mm-hmm. some of my concerns and some of my worries about all of that into the book. But for the most part, I think my dad wouldn't have ultimately cared what I wrote about him, knowing him, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, like,
who reads books anyway?
I know, like my father, when I was working on my last book, he was like, am I in it? He's like, you write bad things about me, don't you? I know you do, but
yeah.
He never actually bothered to read the book because he doesn't right. really have time to read. So, you know, part of his like flaws, I mean, I think what makes him so real is that he's a very flawed character and like all of us, but, his own vulnerability is not that he's American, but he's trying so hard to prove his Americanness. He's like a fan of America, you know, rather than actually being naturally inhabited in whatever it is that is American. And that it made me think about this quote, and it's a very fraught quote, and I was just curious what your opinion of this mm-hmm. of your sure. own passage is.
Uh-huh. Right.
The quote is, we are more obsessed with what they think of us than what we think of ourselves. We spend way too much time trying to correct the impression the West has of who we are. We've turned this defensiveness into a way of life. Edward Said writes a book about how wrong they've been about us, and it becomes our Bible, a high road to self-knowledge. Constantly defining yourself in opposition to what others say about you is not self-knowledge. It's confusion. Mm. So I was wondering what your opinion of this passage is. Do you agree with this? Do you agree with it? And if so, how do Muslims, and I would also encompass other non-white immigrants, untether ourselves from that defensive right. position?
Yeah, that's an amazing question. I'm not sure exactly how to answer it. You know, it's uh-huh. interesting when in writing a book full of mm-hmm. characters, and one of them notably who has my name and many of the facts of my life, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's hard not to, I suppose, give off the impression that everything I quote unquote say in the book is something that I agree with. I wouldn't disagree with it. I mean, I think it's a limited perspective. I think it's an important, it's a thought that I've had in the past. It's a mm-hmm. thought I've articulated to others within my community. Mm-hmm. It's not one that I think is as useful for members who are not of my community to hear, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. How do we detether ourselves if the analysis of that quote is, you know, has any mm-hmm. validity, then how to detether? I mean, I think that by beginning to sort of recognize that deconstructive assertion is not a creative act, mm-hmm. and that it's incumbent on me as a writer, say, to move beyond critique and to move mm-hmm. beyond problematizing discourse, right? Mm-hmm. Foucault mm-hmm. is great. Foucault mm-hmm. doesn't tell us how to build a society. Mm-hmm. Foucault tells us how societies are built. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes worry that in this era of critical theory thinking that we've confused deconstructive assertion or systemic analysis for a constructive creative gesture. Mm-hmm. I think it's an important part of the context. You can't maybe come to a rightful gesture without it, mm-hmm. but it's not enough. And I do worry that Edward Said at times has given some of us the blueprint to think that having an awareness of discursive construction is enough. I'm not sure that it is. And I say that as an artist. You know, I say that as somebody who has to, at the end of the day, give the audience, give the reader a deep emotional and intellectual and absorbing experience. It's not enough to get it right. I have to go much further than that.
I mean, I definitely agree with you. I think it's a provocative statement though, because especially in this time where you have, it's like, it almost seems as if there is no choice but to define yourself in opposition, in this very oppositional era. And to do so would be to kind of almost like deflect accountability in a way, just because of how politicized this era has become. And I would argue, and you may disagree with me, but I would also argue what makes Homeland Elegy kind of a more provocative book rather than, I don't know, say like a coming of age novel, is that it is oppositional. It's oppositional in the sense that, I mean, it's, I think it's artistic in its form and its portraits of all of these very contradictory characters, and also its drama and its and the tragic comedy in it. But it's also, I think, oppositional in that it gives a portrait of Muslims living in a Christian country, Christian land. Right?
Yeah, sure. But you know, this is the thing that I often run into, you know, when with regards to this sort of identity politics of my own work, is that I'm just writing from a particular to a universal. I'm just writing about a group of people and a community and a set of histories. And then from those people, I'm writing about love and I'm writing about greed and I'm writing about society and I'm writing about the self and I'm writing about all kinds of big stuff, big ideas, you know, capital, capital letter stuff. I'm not writing in any conscious way to counter some perception there is about, you know, I'm often, often folks will say, oh, you know, he's writing about Muslim American identity. I'm not, no, I'm not. I it just turns out that, that for many people seeing characters who are struggling in some cases with their place in this country as part of the sort of existential circumstance of their lives becomes a political statement or becomes like some conscious artistic intention. It isn't really. I mean, I was trying to use my family as a, to tell the story of what has happened to the American dream. And so to me, I'm writing about America. I'm not writing in opposition to some perceived representation of Muslims. Though I suspect if I do my job well, there's going to be a richness there that will belie some of the idiotic flattening that happens, you know, but that flattening happens in bad fiction everywhere. I mean, it doesn't, and it happens across all identities and it happens across everything. I mean, it's just bad fiction is just bad fiction. So
No, definitely. I mean, I think like, you know, the book is not so much about identity as is, I mean, it's about a lot of things. It's not just, it doesn't, it's not about just identity. It's about money. It's about capitalism. It's also, it's, and it's very much, as I said before, it's an indictment of the American dream. And I would say that it's not just Muslims sort of defining themselves in opposition to what they're perceived as, but it's also kind of it's a kind of an oppositional look at sort of this national consciousness, this white national consciousness that we have become, that we were sort of inculcated in throughout, at least throughout my life, you know, and I'm seeing this overturned in a lot of American fiction and American poetry is as, what is this myth? What is this American myth? And let's see what it kind of, you know, what the kind of the histories that it's flattened. And I think for that, it's really kind of, it's really powerful. I want to talk about, jump to the Scranton section. And the the character's name is Riaz. Is that how you pronounce his name? Who is the quote unquote merchant of debt and who is the founder of a hedge fund. And he's very charming and almost and a kind of inscrutable philanthropist. And I've read a few descriptions of this book, and I've seen it being compared to Great Gatsby.
Right.
Where he's this kind of Gatsby character. What would you say that's an accurate analogy? What would you say?
It's really kind of a funny one. I mean, it's interesting, you know, that particular review I found sort of perplexing. You know, I guess that there are certain readers I have noticed. I have sort of, you know, kind of, you know, clocked that there are certain readers who feel centrally seduced by that narrative at the heart of the book. And that there's something about the shadow that it casts for them across the rest of the events of the story that make them feel, I think, that that's the central narrative experience that they're having, right?
Yeah.
And I'm confused by that myself because it is at the center of the book. And yes, it is there for a reason in a way, and that there is something very important that I'm trying to do and say and convey narratively with that. But I think that there are narratives, like most notably the father-son thing, that really is much larger frame for what this story is.
Yeah.
So I think it's a funny little twist that I'm discovering. And it's interesting that you bring it up, that it also struck you that way, because I do think that it partakes of a certain American there is a certain American archetype that story plays along with. And that I think there is a way in which that familiarity enables or allows, you know, in contradistinction to the representation of the father and the sort of like the story of the father and son, which is not a traditional immigrant story as I gather, and it's something that a lot of people are saying. So I don't, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, how do you account for it? What are your thoughts about that?
Great Gatsby wasn't the first
me neither.
Reference I had in mind. I thought I was, but I think I read that review. I don't remember what it was, but before I picked up the book, I read that review. And so I thought the book was going to be about these two characters. Mm-hmm. And instead it's multiple characters, father and, and your extended family and, that's one. I mean, it's definitely an important section in the book. For me, it reminded me, Riaz reminded me of this anecdote. Actually, he represents a kind of my own personal familiar trope of an immigrant or a second generation immigrant. It reminds me of this one time where I was at this bar and I never hang around hedge funders, but I went to a bar and there were these hedge funders for this friend's birthday party. And I met a Korean American hedge funder, and he was, he was very successful. He was a billionaire, I believe. And I was just very drunk at the time. And I was asking people, there are some Asians in the bar, and I was just sort of asking them, do you think Asian men are more self-hating or Asian women are more self-hating?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I went up and I was curious what he would say. So I asked him, I was like, what do you think? Do you think Asian men are more self-hating or women are more self-hating? I was sort of doing this research for this book. And then he said, without hesitation, men and Asian men. And I said, why? And he said, well, and obviously this is very misguided of him to say, he said, well, everyone wants Asian women, like white men, black men, Latino men, they all want Asian women. No one wants Asian men. But then he said, but there are more Asian men who are getting into Harvard and Yale and all of these Ivy League schools and any other demographic, and soon will be more powerful than the Jews. And I was thinking of this, that person, that guy.
Sure, who, of course.
When I was
I
thinking
totally
of,
get it. Totally
yeah,
get it.
When I was thinking of Riaz, and I was thinking about just sort of the I don't know. It just gets complicated when you're kind of using, when capitalism collides with racism or, you know, and that's why I was really, and that's why I don't see him so much as a Gatsby, well, maybe, but like, I just found him to be very compelling, how he was using his power as a form of vengeance. And so I was, and how this guy, this Korean guy, was also sort of using it to kind of gain, to prove his masculinity in a way.
Sure. And well, I mean, that's, but that's the thing is that, that, you know, prosperity, American prosperity, you know, is the great equal, is believed to be the great equalizer.
Yeah.
And that, that if you, you know, Riaz is in pursuit of his first $1 billion, because if he can become, you know, the best of the, if he can become part of the minority of the best, that he will then finally be, you know, an American, that he will feel fully American. And, you know, it's a strategy that many people in the book, you know, they have different strategies to do that. To, you know, I have an uncle in the book named Shafat, who becomes a Christian to become, to solve the question of American belonging. And Asha, you know, later in the book, you know, thinks that being with a basketball player is going to do that. And then thinks that arranging her own marriage with a Pakistani is going to do some form of that. And the narrator himself goes through many different iterations of sort of, you know, how to solve this question. But I think that, that certainly there, that, that the money solution, if you will, is one that, that a lot of folks, it sounds like folks you, you know, or at least encountered, a lot of people I know have, you know, settled on that as a strategy to sort of solve this problem.
Well, so, you know, I was thinking of that Wakanian quote you made, you said, where you said, we desire the desire of the other, and which seems to be the crux of the problem of this, it's, of this country. And I don't know. I mean, this is, I mean, as we're, I wonder though, I mean, do you think, no, I mean, we're heading, this is a question that's not, that's sort of drifting from the craft of the book and so forth.
Sure, that's all good, all good. Well, I'm happy to talk about whatever you, whatever, wherever this goes.
I'm wondering then, is this like, I mean, does capitalism then trump all? Does it matter, you think, that like, you know, America, where, you know, the immigrants, the black and brown immigrants are going to be the majority in 2050, if capitalism, if we continue, you know, if it's going to be, if you're continuing to, if we're going to continue living in this neoliberal system, then it doesn't matter who is, you know, if this country is white or majority black or majority brown or majority anything.
I do worry, Kathy, that the identity politics analysis of the ailments of the country is short-sighted. And I do worry that the real issues are fundamentally economic, and that the systemic problems are, sure, we've got racism, no question. But the systemic economic issues are actually existential, and not just existential to a particular, you know, group of people, but to the species. And I don't know that, it seems to me that capitalism is an equal opportunity, you know, is it's a system that benefits anybody who understands how to align itself with that system. And so I don't know that, I'm not sure, I think it's probably clear from the book that I'm not convinced that racial justice, pursuing racial justice over pursuing these more fundamental, we can do them both, but not giving as much attention to the economic questions, I think is ultimately going to serve us, is not going to serve us well, is my worry.
Well, it's inextricable. I think you can't separate the two. You have to, and you can't
I mean, that's what you just suggested that we could. And I think that's the shadow side of this, is that achieving success, you know, at the end of the day, if folks are able to make, you know, Mike Jacobs in the book is, you know, he's a libertarian Republican who is using all his money and all his wealth to make black lives better in America. And Riaz is doing the same thing for Muslims, right?
Yeah.
But so he's taking care of their own kind. And if they prevail, they will help usher in a new era of empowerment for a particular group of people. But the system that is the predatory system that is despoiling the actual nation itself is still very much at work. So I do think that those things can be decoupled. I think that it's hard to make progress on the racial justice front without addressing some of the economic issues. But I think that if we don't focus more clearly on the economic issues that affect the entire nation and the entire, by extension, the entire world, the human population, we're going to have a rough go of it.
Time for a short break. When we come back, Ayad tries to demystify a friend's politics and examines how America pillages itself. Stick around. Welcome back to this bookable conversation with Kathy Park Hong and Ayad Akhtar.
I want to actually pivot to Mike Jacobs' character, but sure. I do think that it's not. I mean, I think a lot of the concerns right now is not simply identity politics. It seems like with a lot of at least people of color, it's racial capitalism. It's rather than lifting up oneself, or I think a lot of people have soured on the idea of individual triumph. And I want to talk about Mike Jacobs. You know,
sure.
I think that he's. I wanted to talk about how you. A chapter is devoted on this Hollywood agent who's Black, and he's Republican, and he believes he's very, probably like Riaz, he's very, almost very cynical. You know, I would kind of call him an Afro-pessimist who believes
right.
that, you know, there's no way to redeem this country.
Right.
So he decides to vote Republican. And
so that he doesn't have to pay taxes, so he doesn't have to pay money to the U.S. government.
Yeah, but he doesn't have to pay money. But then, and I was thinking about, you know, this, like, just recently about other, you know, how a lot of, there are more Black and Latinx male voters who are supporting Trump in 2020 more so than in 2016. But it's not just that he doesn't want to pay more taxes. It's also because he doesn't think that his money is going to any programs that will help Black people, even if it's a Democrat in power. So he wants to take control of his own money and give it to Black programs himself. And what inspired you to write this character, and why did you decide to incorporate him in a book that takes on the perspectives of other Muslim Americans?
So Mike is based on somebody real, somebody that I've known quite some time. Mike's politics have, as I say in the book, or as the narrator who has my name and many of the facts of my life says in the book, his politics have always baffled me. And so, you know, Mike's perspective felt like the perfect perspective to begin to understand some of the things we were just talking about, was this sort of the larger economic despoiling of the country that is not about race, that is really about what Mary at the top of the book suggests is a kind of colonial pillage, that the country has been pillaging itself and plundering itself, and individuals have treated America not as a homeland, but as a place to make their fortunes, and that there really isn't any abiding sense of loyalty to a collective. There is the abiding sense of loyalty to oneself and to fulfilling the American dream, if you will. Like, that becomes the sort of ideological, you know, the short form signifier for a whole bunch of other stuff, right? And so Mike, in the book, Mike offers a very clear way into an analysis of just how the politics of the last 40 years, you know, notably antitrust regulation, has led to a landscape where communities, where the heartland has been, you know, sort of impoverished, mm-hmm. where the rural regions have become impoverished, and mm-hmm. where the consumer getting the lowest price seems to have come to stand in for a kind of social covenant, you mm-hmm. know, above all. Mm-hmm. And that his argument as a Black American and his ability to sort of see that because of his father's history, but also because of his own politics, provides, I think, an important dimension of this picture. This mm-hmm. picture, which at the end of the chapter, the narrator, you know, encounters It's a Wonderful Life for the umpteenth time, but after this conversation with Mike Jacobs, realizes that Frank Capra was sort of expressing a vision of this version of America all along, and that it really did map against property rights, that mm-hmm. it really was about property, and that mm-hmm. the perspective of property is different than the perspective of, you know, the human, if you will. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that this is a deeper struggle that's playing itself out, and property has very clearly won. It's won mm-hmm. so extraordinarily. I mean, it's the concussive, decisive victory of property rights is evidenced by the world economy being fueled by debt, that these mm-hmm. things are interconnected. Mm-hmm. So that's that, you know, it was important for me, I think, to, you know, it was a kind of just, you know, I it wasn't planned. I got to mm-hmm. that point in the book and I knew that I would be pivoting. I was sort of coming into the home stretch and I was coming back to the fundamental picture. I needed to draw a very large version, very large, sort of a short chapter with a very large vision of the picture. I knew what that mm-hmm. picture would be. And I knew that Mike was going to play some part in that because, you know, again, as I said, he's based substantially on somebody real.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think he definitely seemed like he was based on a real character. And I was I would say that was one of the chapters that I found to be a little bit surprising and a little bit shocking because I haven't seen that kind of seen that perspective. I haven't read that perspective before, however, definitely the cynicism mm-hmm. and, you know, a lot of Black Americans not believing in American democracy because they've right. been, because they've been shut out of the promise of accruing wealth and having property. And themselves being property.
Right.
You know, but that, which also, of course, differentiates some, you know, Mike Jacobs, who's Black too, from an immigrant. Right. Let's see.
Yeah, so, that's right. Yeah, I think that's partly also part of it too, is that, you know, as a member of the sort of first generation born here immigrant class, I think that, you know, there's been a kind of intellectual coming of age for me that I, you know, I've had to go to school on forms of the Black experience that I've been able to sort of make sense of and internalize to whatever degree I can, whether it was, you know, Malcolm X or James Baldwin or whatever it may be, or Mike, or, you know, who for a time has, you know, really been one of my closest friends. So, uh-huh. I think learning about race identity in America as a first generation, you know, sort of Pakistani American, I have had to understand a little bit better, or tried to understand a little bit better, what it means to be Black in this country to make sense of those questions.
Well, I mean, because it's like if you think about Black enslavement, that is inextricable from capitalism, right? Because a lot of the accrual of capital in this country is based on Black bodies, using Black bodies as collateral. But and it seems like that chapter on Mike Jacobs kind of speaks to that, or that's a lot of where the foundation of his cynicism is that this isn't going to change. It's unchangeable. And maybe this is some of the, and there, I think you see kind of like the existential it's rage or existential acceptance or
right, you know, right,
just
right.
like this is how it is. And so I right. might as well game the system, which I right. think is, it's even, again, it seems different than Riaz. I don't know why, but it just seems more.
Oh, I think it is. I think Riaz, first of all, is it's a different echelon of wealth and a different ability to affect. And also a different ambition. You know, Riaz is seeking to have a kind of role that Sheldon Adelson has in American politics. I mean, he has a pretty high dream. You know, Mike probably doesn't have the same. He's probably happy to spend, you know, a few $100,000 a year on some programs that really mean a lot to him, or, you know, whatever it may be. He doesn't have that sort of expansive ambition. And I think it's part of why the narrator says, you know, it felt like bullshit to me. Like it was cover for what he wanted to do, which was to make money and keep his money.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I want to talk about the book itself. I was wondering, I think you probably get asked this question a lot about going from a playwright to a novel. And I was curious, like what are some of the books that served as a model for you for this book that were an inspiration when you were working on, when you're trying to figure out the format of this book?
It's interesting. I, you know, there was one book that kind of set off the writing, if you will, and that was Bellows Rabelstein. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a kind of, Chick in Ravelstein is clearly Saul Bellow, and Ravelstein is clearly Alan Bloom. And so it was it's sort of one-to-one Romain Auclay that felt, you know, precariously close to memoir. And there was a kind of vividness of characterization that was married to really rich social history. Mm-hmm. And Bellow doesn't ever sort of engage in outright social history, but he comes close. I mean, it's a short novel, so it's a very different... Mm-hmm. But I think that there was the ambition to marry ideas, experience, sensual detail, and strong, vivid characterizations. I think the idea of that kind of an alloy came from reading Ravelstein, which I read just before I started writing this book, and I didn't know I was going to be writing this book. Mm-hmm. But I remember thinking, "Wow, God, why can't I write like this?" I think the other big template for me, and I look back now and it's clear that this book has been cooking in me for at least a decade. And, you know, I recognize all these abandoned ideas that ended up sort of finding form here in this story, in this series of stories. Was it the Philip Roth trilogy, you know, American Pastoral, I Married a Communist, and Human Stain, and the sort of way in which, again, the contiguousness of the narrator's consciousness with the text makes it start to feel like there's a very intimate address to the reader. Mm-hmm. And this notion, sorry, there's a passing train here in downtown Chatham.
Sure.
Let me just hold on a sec.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That to me, married to the larger theme of the social construction of the self. I think those were the kinds of books that informed the ambition or the sort of at least the texture of what it was. But as far as the formal dimension of it, I didn't have a template other than to know that I'd read so many wonderful books over the years that broke form, you know, whether it was, you know, Moby Dick or whether it was Tristram Shandy or Walden, you know, which isn't a novel, but still there's this, that there's a freedom that, you know, if you have the craft to do it, you can pretty much do whatever you want inside a novel. I think been demonstrated time and again, in the history of the form. So I think I knew that there would probably be people who just weren't going to come along for the ride. And that was just what it was. And in this time of online merchandise and sort of online groupthink and all of that, so there is an increasingly prescriptive version of what a novel is in its commercial embodiment, even in the literary form. So I knew there might be some resistance to something that was a little bit more whatever, highfalutin or the hijinks of form and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But it didn't matter to me so much. I just thought, I'm gonna see if mm-hmm. I can do this and just let the cards fall where they may.
Maybe because I'm a poet, but I think that my favorite kinds of novels that are novels that always defy the genre in some way.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. And there are a lot of those. Yeah. And I think, that's what keeps the genre alive. I was curious about the process in writing the book. I know a lot of these characters are based on real people. I was wondering if you, what the research process was like. Did you go back and interview many of these people? Was there any kind of reporting involved or maybe you could even speak about your experience as a playwright?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a motley group. I mean, some of the characters are concocted. Mm-hmm. Some of them are composited. So I have a couple of characters that are really strong composites of a few different points of view. Mm-hmm. And then there are two or three characters who, Mike Jacobs being one of them, mm-hmm. who is substantially based on somebody real. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, in Mike's case, I shared that chapter with the original subject of the portrayal. Mm-hmm. And I asked him to make comments, and where I quote him, that is his quote. But he did not want to be formally attributed as such. Mm-hmm. In the case of my father, there's a lot of deforming of fact that's going into the portrayal of my father, but it again is substantially real. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the court case, my father did go through a malpractice lawsuit in his career. It was about 10 years before he actually ended up ending his career. So it wasn't quite at the end of his career, but I did do a lot of research and interviews of lawyers, and I had all of the court transcripts. And, but again, I substantially departed in actually shaping the court experience. I departed from the original. I often say that, I do all this prep and I do all this preparation and all this research and, sometimes it'll be months and months and months of research and then I'll quickly write a draft. And a lot of times I do all the research to be able to understand the difference between an arbitrary surprise and a creative surprise. And because if I don't, then I can just get lost in, I can walk down some path that leads to a dead end if I don't really understand very fully the world that I'm writing about. Mm-hmm. So it ran the gamut. There was a lot of research in a couple of instances, as the court case and also to some extent this thing about Mike. But a lot of the other stuff was, as I said earlier, been cooking for so many years. I'd been accumulating, all kinds of stories and episodes and scenes and, a friend who had encountered the SEC and the details of that get folded into my own account of the narrator and being encountering the SEC. And, it's all of that stuff. It's just a typical sort of writer accumulating material over the course of a lifetime, if you will.
It definitely reads like that. Also, I was interestingly in the book, and I guess this is why it's sometimes part of the reason why people say auto fiction or whatever, but which has kind of become a sort of played term. But you do there's some meta narrative moments in your book, or I don't even know if meta narrative is a way to call it, intertextual, where there you write about your play and the reception of your play, and I thought that was really interesting. And it seems to be, at first it seems ostensibly it kind of reads as a defense of your play, but more it seems to be like, it seems like you write about the reception of your play as kind of to open up kind of these larger debates about politics and audience and art making. And maybe the last time, but it specifically, it seems to be the Muslim reaction to your play, you sure. know, and then the last, and perhaps maybe one of the more sympathetic people who react to your plays is this, and confess I haven't seen it, is Sultan, who says, everybody has flaws. We're no exception. We're under attack in this country now. We have to stick together. So I wanted to, I was wondering if you could talk about that, why you chose to be so transparent about this narrator's play that is your play, and why you decided to talk about its reception.
So the opening of the book begins with an account of my, you know, the narrator's father's relationship to Donald Trump, which eventually leads to his support of Donald Trump during the election, 2015, 2016, or during the campaign. And, you know, the problems that arise, the problems that arise between father and son because of that. And sort of, I knew at the end of that chapter that the immediate question that the reader would have in retrospect, you know, sort of thinking back on what they just read, is how much of this is real. So the beginning of the next chapter is called On Autobiography, in which I address both directly and indirectly the question of the veracity of what people are reading. But I address that question of veracity by speaking about another work, not the one that they're reading now, but another one that I had written before. And I give an example of how I am asked about, you know, that work, and I'm asked about how much of me is in it, and what people are really inquiring about is about my politics, which then leads to a story about my mother, which I allege, or the narrator alleges, is the real source of the material that was in the play that has everybody so hot and bothered, right? All of this is a very elaborate hermeneutic maneuver on my part. To both enlist the reader in this trompe-l'oeil, if you will, this tricking of the eye, no pun intended. And on the other hand, also to begin to tread the ground of what's ahead, which will eventually lead to the episode with Riaz. Because on the one hand, the narrator is going to go through a real rise in the world, if you will. We'll achieve a version of the American dream to some... to some consequence, to some nefarious consequence on the one hand. And so the vehicle of that transformation will be this play. And on the other hand, it also allows me, the writer, to begin to open up some of this contested ground around representation of Muslims and how a writer who is both writing about, but not identifying as overtly, but identified as by others overtly, a Muslim writer, is dealing with all of these questions as they pertain to his own experience in America. Because that, of course, is the subject of the Scranton chapter, where he gets, the narrator gets to the end of that chapter and says, I was going to stop pretending I felt like an American. And that paradoxically, that epiphany is what leads to him, his success as a writer in America. So bringing the play was a very useful way for me to begin that process of doing all of that stuff. Now, that's the obvious sort of, like, at least the formal and the sort of conscious part of it. I'm sure there's some unconscious dimension to it, which is, you know, I have had to account for my intentions and my all of that sort of stuff with some of my work over the past few years in the theater, especially after Disgraced won a Pulitzer and got so much attention. You know, I've had to sort of speak to what the play is and what it isn't. And, you know, I have been subject to many, many misreadings, most of them very positive, which is often, you know, I joke, is really the only reason I have a career, is because I've been misread so positively by people. And so the paradoxes of all of that, being an artist in an increasingly politicized discursive environment, trying to write to something that is not necessarily political, but also, you know, all of those sorts of those dimensions, those questions which preoccupy me, which are part of the experience that I'm writing about, it felt like the perfect, it was the perfect segue. It was the perfect way in, if you will. And does allow me to partake of this, as I said, this trompe-l'oeil. You know, people have been using the term autofiction. I think of it less as autofiction because I think autofiction has a kind of inherent distance between the reader and the narrator. The writer almost has to go out of his or her way to sort of say, yes, I know it's based on me, but this is not me. But here the book is really saying, you know what? I want you to confuse this with me. And I'd like to get closer to you, reader, than usual. I would, and so I kind of think of it more like a literary version of kind of reality TV seduction, if you will.
Reality TV. I guess it would be a more popular, lower brow. Although I don't know, there's a lot of quality reality TV there out there too. I was thinking about that as you were opening it up. You started with the play, with your play, and then it opened up to the speaker's mother, and how I guess the quote that was very controversial: "They deserve what they got and what they're going to get," right?
Right.
That's it being attributed to the mother figure, who I found to be a very compelling and tragic. And complex woman, and I was in, and as well as the other women in your book as well. I just had one, which I would love to get to, but we're almost out of time. And I just wanted to ask one question,
sure.
One last question. The book ends, with father ends up back in Pakistan,
yeah,
and the narrator, after renouncing his Americanness, calls America his home.
Yeah.
And I thought it made the book complete in a way. But I'm wondering, I have to ask, since we're only a few days away from Tuesday.
right.
Yeah, and you coming from Wisconsin, Milwaukee, like, what are your thoughts now, in terms of this country? A lot of your book is kind of covers the trauma of 2016, the elections. And do you have any, I don't know, you could just really say anything, any thoughts or predictions about.
I don't have a prediction. I mean, obviously, I think we all are sort of thinking, I think maybe with better reason to think so, we'll probably have an outcome at the end of, whatever this next period is, that will be a little bit saner for our lives. I do continue to worry that the underlying structural tensions and problems, that Trump was not the problem. He ended up becoming a problem.
Yes.
He has been a big problem. He's almost like, if the cancer was caused by some toxicity in the environment, well, the cancer is ultimately what ends up killing you. But if you cure that cancer and you don't change the environment, you're going to have cancer again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're in an environment where, yes, it's incumbent on us. It's imperative that we get rid of Trump. But I think he's not the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that we've created an environment where Trump is possible. And that, to me, I don't want to stretch the far metaphor too much, but I have spoken on a couple of occasions about parallels with the late Roman Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think, one of the things in retrospect with the hindsight of, a few thousand years, we can sort of see that Caesar's attempt to centralize power, which was expressing some breakdown in the society, not entirely caused by Caesar's own will to power, but that his will to power was an expression of some impulse within the society, it's a Hegelian reading of the events, that Caesar's attempt to centralize power did not succeed, and that the Republic fighting back only served to actually undermine the rest of those Republican fundamentals that led ultimately to Augustus. And that Augustus was the one who centralized power and led to 200 years of, prosperity and peace, but under authoritarian rule. Mm-hmm. And that I worry that there are parallels if you look at the relationship of the aristocrats to the social body, and you look at sort of, the collapse of the breakdown of the monopoly on violence that the state, generally tends to have and which legitimizes its rule. I think that there is a case to be made that we are in the very earliest stages of a collapse of certain fundaments that could very well lead to the kind of centralizing of power that Trump has represented in its kind of dysfunctional form, and that its next embodiment will be far, far more effective. And so 24, 28, I mean, I think that there are much larger societal questions at play here. And to me, they all ultimately boil down to where the money is going. And I don't see it as simple as billionaires own everything, though I think that's certainly a valid way of seeing it, an important sort of gloss on it. I think that the system has incentivized decision-making in a certain way, and that this monetizing imperative is creating a whole set or whole thicket of problems for us that if we don't figure out how to deal with, are going to continue to create the kind of widespread discontent and nihilism that has led to Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's sort of my larger sort of thing about it. I hope that we can move the needle in a positive direction. And hopefully this younger generation of folks thinking about something other than, you know, individualism and you know, maybe there will be meaningful economic reform, and that we will begin to countenance the possibility of things like community stakeholdership when it comes to shareholder rights. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's just a lot of stuff that's off the table in 21st century America because the ideological soil has been so fully tilled. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we can't really even talk about certain things, mm-hmm. but hopefully that'll change. Well, one hopes that can change.
I hope so too.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kathy and Ayad, for such an insightful and meaningful conversation. I will now go look up some words in the dictionary. Kathy Park Hong is the author of Minor Feelings. It's published by One World and is available now. Ayad Akhtar is the author of Homeland Elegies, a novel. It's published by Little Brown and Company and is also available now. Bookable is a production of Loud Tree Media. I'm your host, Amanda Stern, 5 feet tall, but 5'8" if you're using the Electoral College. We're produced by me, Beau Friedlander, and Andrew Dunn, who also mixes and sound designs the show. Beau is Loudtree's editor-in-chief. Find us on the web at bookablepod.com and subscribe and rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows. And if you want to learn more about our guests, find us on Instagram at bookablepod and follow me, your host, at A Little Stern. We're back next week with another new episode of Bookable, and we will see you then. This is Bookable.